And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin.
And in future crime news, Minority Report may actually be coming to fruition. Kinda. Now, if you haven't seen Minority Report, this is a movie from, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, starring Tom Cruise, that basically was about three psychics that could predict crime ahead of time, meaning if I was going to wake up one morning and kill my neighbor, I would be arrested before that act because the psychic said that, well, Nick's going to wake up and go kill his neighbor. Not that I like my neighbors, they're cool, but, you know, so there you go. And obviously the whole premise of that is, well, can you really predict crime? What if my intent changed, you know, and they didn't see it? You know, there you go. So Minority Report, that's what we're talking about, but not quite. So here's what's going on. This is coming from the Washington Post. And as the United States faces rising rates of violent crime, another research project is now emerging. A group of University of Chicago scientists unveiled an algorithm last month boasting in a news release of its ability to predict crime with, quote, 90% accuracy. Now, the algorithm identifies locations in major cities that it calculates have a high likelihood of crimes, including homicides and burglaries, occurring within the next week, within 7 days. The software can also evaluate how policing across various neighborhoods in eight major cities that they're testing this in the United States, including Chicago, LA, and Philadelphia, this can determine those things. But using artificial intelligence to direct law enforcement is obviously ringing alarm bells for many social justice scholars and criminologists who cite a long history of such technology unfairly suggesting that increased policing of Black and Latino people are needed, meaning there's bias inherent in the artificial intelligence in the past. Now, even one of the study's authors acknowledges that the algorithm's ability to predict crime is limited. Now, Ashanhu Chattopadhyay, he is a professor from the University of Chicago and the lead researcher of this algorithm, said, and I quote, "The past does not tell you anything about the future. The question is, to what degree does the past actually influence the future? And to what degree are the events spontaneous or truly random? Our ability to predict is limited by that." Meaning, this isn't going to be perfect, but they think they've got it to 90%. Now, over the last 15 years or so, the country's largest police departments, such as New York, LA, Chicago, etc., have started thinking about ways of using artificial intelligence, not just to analyze crime, but to also predict it. They often turn to data analytics companies such as Predpol or Palantir, which create software that law enforcement can use to forecast crime. Predictive policing tools are built by feeding data, such as crime reports, arrest records, license plate images, etc., to an algorithm, which is then trained to look for patterns to predict where and when a certain type of crime will occur in the future. But the algorithms are only as good as the data they are fed, which is the problem, particularly for people in the United States. This is according to Vincent Sutherland. He is the co-faculty director of the New York University's Center on Race, Inequality, and the Law. Now, historically, police data in the United States is biased, according to Sutherland. Cops are more likely to arrest or charge someone with a crime in low-income neighborhoods dominated by people of color. That's a reality that doesn't necessarily reflect where crime is happening, but where crimes are spent, but where the police are spending their time. That means most data sets of criminal activity overrepresent people of color and low-income neighborhoods. Feeding that data into an algorithm leads it to suggest more criminal activity is in those areas, creating a type of feedback loop that is racially and socioeconomically biased, according to Sutherland. Quote, "You have data that is infected by or tainted by some bias, and that bias is going to appear on the other side of the analysis. You get out of it what you put into it." And in that sense, he's absolutely true. But this team in the at the University of Chicago basically said that they know that a lot of these past algorithms have a troubling past. And so in making this algorithm, this team segmented major cities into 100 square foot city blocks 1,000 square foot city blocks, and then use city crime data from the last 3 to 5 years to train it. The algorithm then spits out whether there is high or low risk of crime happening in that segment at a certain time up to 1 week in the future. And to limit bias, the team omitted crime data such as marijuana arrests, traffic stops, or low-level petty crimes because research shows that Black and Latino people are more often targeted for those types of offenses. Instead, they gave the algorithm data on homicides, assaults, and batteries, along with property crimes like burglaries and motor vehicle thefts. But the main point of the study, they said, was to use the algorithm to interrogate how the police are biased. His team compared arrest data from neighborhoods of varying socioeconomic levels. They found crime happen in wealthier wealthier areas led to more arrests, where in poorer neighborhoods, crime didn't always have the same effect, which therefore shows a discrepancy in enforcement. I think that's a really interesting observation. They also said that these results help provide evidence to people who complain that law enforcement ignores poorer neighborhoods when there's a spike in violent or property crime. Quote, this allows you to quantify for that, to show the evidence. So I think it's actually kind of important right now to mention intent on this one. I talked about artificial intelligence actually in my third TED Talk, and typically the intent of the creator is not to create something that's racist or even biased, but bias can naturally creep in. For example, look at facial recognition technology. There is a heavy false positive rate among minority populations, up to 35% at times, primarily because those who helped develop the AI were mostly white, and therefore they were testing and training the AI on white people, right? So if the AI has never seen a Black person, there's going to be more false positives. It's got to learn every type of face, every type of complexion, color, you name it, et cetera, to be as accurate as possible. And that's not intentional on the developers. You know, that's really not. I don't think they went out to set up a racist facial recognition system. They just used what they had at hand, and here we are. I think the goal should be then to learn from that mistake and be more inclusive in their development. That was the point that I made in that talk. So I think that AI in policing is interesting, but also to the point here, a very concerning prospect when these products are used and they're not fully matured or still have some unintended inherent bias. That actually was a recent case where a Black guy, I want to say it was in Oakland, San Francisco or Oakland, and West Coast, essentially was in jail for a year because the AI-based facial recognition system gave him a false positive, said that, yes, he actually was the suspect in the picture when he wasn't. And it took the police and investigators a year, literally a year, to figure out that this guy was not actually the perpetrator of this particular crime. And then they released him. That's what we're talking about. So going off and having artificial intelligence that is not, is 90% accurate sounds great, but that 10% are the potential 10% that could be falsely arrested or imprisoned. I don't want to, look like a perpetrator and then the artificial intelligence mistakes that guy for me, and now I'm being arrested for a crime I didn't commit. I mean, that's essentially what we're potentially talking about here. So I think if we're going to use AI, it has to be bulletproof. It has to be as accurate as humanly possible. And while 97 is a pretty amazing step compared to the other ones, we're nowhere near ready for this. But nevertheless, police is going to keep on moving forward. And that's, I think, the unfortunate reality of the situation. So that is your Minority Report news of the week. And in ride-sharing news, we have to talk about Uber, because Uber is a horrible, horrible company. Now, here's what's going on. This is coming from a great report from The Guardian by Harry Davies, Simon Goodley, Felicity Lawrence, Paul Lewis, and Lisa O'Carroll. And I'm going to quote just directly right out of the gate their article. A leaked trove of confidential files has revealed the inside story of how the tech giant Uber flouted laws, duped police, exploited violence against drivers, and secretly lobbied governments during its aggressive global expansion. End quote. That is what we are talking about today. Now, I have to say right out of the gate, because I don't want to get sued, Uber is under new management since this era, but I think they have a lot to explain here as well, and we will go through that. Now, this unprecedented leak of more than 124,000 documents, which The Guardian is calling the Uber files, lays bare the ethically questionable practices that fueled the company's transformation into one of Silicon Valley's most famous and hottest exports around the globe. The Guardian led a global investigation into the leaked Uber files, sharing the data with media organizations around the world via the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, or ICIJ. More than 180 journalists at 40 media outlets, including Le Monde in France, The Washington Post here in the United States, and the BBC in the UK, will be or have been publishing in the last couple of days a series on this investigative report, meaning they're all taking a piece of this and they're all dumping it out to the world. The leak spans a 5-year period when Uber was run by its co-founder, Travis Kalanick, who tried to force the cab hailing service into cities around the world, even if that meant breaching laws and taxi regulations. The files also cover Uber's operations across 40 countries during a period in which the company became a global behemoth, bulldozing its cab hailing service into many of the cities in which it still operates today. During the fierce global backlash, the data shows how Uber tried to shore up support by discreetly courting prime ministers, presidents, billionaires, oligarchs, and media barons. It's just absolutely insane. Now, leaked messages suggest that Uber executives were also at the time under no illusions about the company's lawbreaking, with one executive joking that they had become quote-unquote pirates, and another conceding, quote, we're just effing illegal. Now, basically, about a week ago Monday or so, as you're listening to this, Mark McGann, Uber's former chief lobbyist for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, came forward to identify himself as the source of the leaked data. Quote, it is my duty to speak up and help governments and parliamentarians right some fundamental wrongs. Morally, I had no choice in the matter. Now, the Keisha files, which spans 2013 through 2017, includes more than 83,000 emails, iMessages, and WhatsApp messages, including often frank and unvarnished communications between founder Kalanick and his top team. In one exchange, Kalanick dismisses concerns from other executives that sending Uber drivers to a protest in France put them at risk of violence from angry opponents in the taxi industry. Quote, I think it's worth it. Violence guarantees success. Now, in a statement, Kalanick's spokesperson said that he, quote, never suggested that Uber should take advantage of violence at the expense of driver safety, end quote. And any suggestion that he was involved in such activity would be completely false. That is his response. But the leaked email also contains text between Kalanick and Emmanuel Macron, that is the current president of France, who secretly helped the company in France when he was the economy minister. He wasn't president then, he was the economy minister, allowing Uber frequent and direct access to him and his staff. Now, Macron, as I mentioned, who is the current French president, appears to have gone to extraordinary lengths to help Uber, even telling the company that he had brokered a secret quote-unquote deal with its opponents in the French cabinet. Privately, Uber executives expressed barely disguised disdain for other elected officials who were less receptive to the company's business model. After the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who was the mayor at Hamburg at the time, pushed back against Uber lobbyists and insisted on paying the drivers a minimum wage, an executive told colleagues he was, quote, a real comedian, end quote. When the then U.S. Vice President, now President Joe Biden, he was a supporter of Uber at the time, was late to a meeting with the company at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Kalanick texted a colleague, quote, I've had my people let him know that every minute late he is 1 minute less he will have with me. I mean, what a jerk. It's the Vice President of the United States, and that's the attitude you're taking. Oh, if he's 5 minutes late, he gets 5 minutes less with me. Dude, screw you. Anyway, I am not a fan of Uber, for the record. Full disclosure. I will tell you about my story later on. Now, after meeting Kalanick, then VP Biden appears to have amended his prepared speech at Davos to refer to a CEO whose company would give millions of workers, quote, freedom to work as many hours as they wish, manage their own lives as they wish. Now, in a statement responding to the leak, Uber admitted to, quote unquote, mistakes and missteps, but said that it had transformed since 2017 under the leadership of its new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi. And I'm probably butchering that. Dara, I apologize. Now, Kalanick's spokesperson said Uber's expansion initiatives, quote, were led by over 100 leaders in dozens of countries around the world and at all times under the direct oversight with the full approval of Uber's robust legal policy and compliance groups. Now, from Moscow to Johannesburg, bankrolled basically with unprecedented venture capital funding, they got so much money. Uber heavily subsidized journeys, basically seducing drivers and passengers on the app with incentives and pricing models that were essentially not sustainable. Uber undercut established taxi and cab markets and put pressure on governments to rewrite laws to help pave the way for an app-based gig economy of work that has since proliferated across the world. Basically, they essentially started the gig economy. Now, in a bid to quell the fierce backlash against the company and win changes to taxi and labor laws, Uber planned to spend an extraordinary $90 million in 2016 on lobbying and public relations, according to one document. Its strategy often involved going over the heads of city mayors and transport authorities and straight to the seat of power. In addition to meeting then Vice President Biden at Davos, Uber executives also met face-to-face with Macron, the Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny, the Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and George Osborne, the UK's Chancellor at the time. A note from the meeting portrayed Osborne as a quote-unquote strong advocate. Now, in a statement, Osborne said that it was the explicit policy of the government at the time to meet with global tech firms and, quote, persuade them to invest in Britain and create jobs here, end quote. While the Davos sit-down with Osborne was declared, the data reveals that six UK Tory cabinet ministers had meetings with Uber that were not disclosed. It is unclear if these meetings should have been declared, exposing confusion around how UK lobbying rules were applied in this situation. The document also indicates that Uber was adept at finding unofficial routes to power, applying influence through friends or intermediaries, or seeking out encounters with politicians, at which aides and officials were not present. And the list of the backings of powerful figures in places such as Russia, Italy, and Germany by offering them prized financial stakes in the startup and turning them into quote-unquote strategic investors. This is essentially, and it just goes on and on and on, you know, about lobbyists, bullying, all these kinds of things. This is a huge thing. During taxi strikes, taxi strikes and riots in Paris, Kalanick ordered French executives to retaliate by encouraging Uber drivers to stage counter-protests, even knowing that there was going to be a huge problem. I will quote the article directly here, warning that doing so risked putting Uber drivers at risk of attacks from quote-unquote extreme right thugs who had infiltrated the taxi protests and were quote-unquote spoiling for a fight. Kalanick appeared to urge his team to press ahead regardless. Quote, I think it's worth it. Violence guarantees success, and these guys must be resisted. No, agreed that right place and time must be thought out. In other words, he was totally, totally fine with violence. So Uber needs to go away. They're a hot mess. I know that they have a new CEO. Nevertheless, how many people from that culture are still there, still pervasive? Huge problem. I think they need to go. And so that is your horrible Uber news of the week. And in Wikipedia news, this is why Wikipedia can't be a primary reference or a resource for you if you're doing any kind of research or homework. This is insane. This is amazing, but this is absolutely insane. And so don't get me wrong here. I actually like Wikipedia. If I want some minor or innocuous information, you know, I think we all hit it up from time to time in that which way, you know. So if I'm like, oh, you know, what is the general population of country X? I'll go to Wikipedia. Usually it's right. So we all like it. I also love the concept of what they're trying to achieve. The problem is not everybody who contributes to Wikipedia actually contributes in good faith, and here we are. And so this news is actually coming from Vice News, and it's rather interesting and eye-opening, especially if you use Wikipedia regularly. Now, posing as a scholar, a Chinese woman spent years writing, and I mean years, writing alternative accounts of medieval Russian history on Chinese Wikipedia, conjuring imaginary states, battles, and aristocrats in one of the largest hoaxes on the open source platform. Now, if you didn't know, Wikipedia comes in many different languages. So if you're living in China, you can go to Chinese Wikipedia. It's the same format, same standard, obviously, as the United States one or the English one, as it would be in France or German, or, you know, take your pick. So understand that this woman is in China writing for Chinese Wikipedia, and this is fascinating. Now, this scam was exposed last month by Chinese novelist Yin Fan, who was researching for a book when he became upon an article on the Kashin Silver Mine. Now, according to the Wikipedia article, Discovered by Russian peasants in 1344, the mine engaged more than 40,000 slaves and freed men, providing a remarkable source of wealth for the Russian principality of Tver in the 14th and 15th centuries, as well as subsequent regimes. The geological composition of the soil, the structure of the mine, and even the refining process were all fleshed out in detail in this Wikipedia article. Yin Fan thought that he had found an interesting bit of material for his novel, but little did he know he had stumbled upon an entire fictitious world created by a user simply known as Shi Mao. Now, it was one of 206 articles that she had written on Chinese Wikipedia since 2019, although it goes farther than back, weaving facts into fiction in an elaborate scheme that went uncaught for years and tested the limits of Wikipedia's platform's ability to verify information and fend off bad actors. Now, according to veteran Chinese Wikipedian John Yip, quote, "The content she wrote is of high quality and the entries were interconnected, creating a system that can exist on its own. Shi Mao single-handedly invented a new way to undermine Wikipedia." Now, Yin Fan was tipped off when he ran the silver mine story by Russian speakers and fact-checked Shi Mao's references, only to find that the pages or versions of the books that she cited simply did not exist. She made them up. People he consulted also called her out on her lengthy entries on ancient conflicts between Slavic states, which could not be found in any Russian historical records. Yin Fan wrote, quote, "They were so rich in details, they put English and Russian Wikipedia to shame." Now, the scale of the scam came to light after a group of volunteer editors and other Wikipedians, such as Yip, combed through the past contribution of almost 300 articles. One of her longest articles was almost the length of the novel, The Great Gatsby. With the formal authoritative tone of an encyclopedia, it detailed three Tartar uprisings in the 17th century that left a lasting impact on Russia, complete with a map that Shi Mao had actually made. In another entry, she shared rare images of ancient coins, which she claimed to have obtained from a Russian archaeological team. One article she tampered with heavily, basically, was on the deportation of Chinese in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. It was so well written, it was actually selected as a featured article and translated into other languages, including English, Arabic, and Russian, obviously spreading the damage to other language editions of Wikipedia. I could have read that and thought, oh my gosh, like, this is really interesting history. I like history, and it would have been completely fake. Now, among the first users to interact, how deep this goes. Among the first users to interact with her, Yip almost couldn't believe himself when he learned how she had tricked the system. Editors normally presume that writers are contributing in good faith. Yet Ye Yuchia, he is a volunteer editor who plays the role of a patroller and rollbacker who had helped contain the fallout, was basically stating this, quote, "When surveying new content, we only check whether it's blatant plagiarism and if it has proper sources. She understood the format of Wikipedia very well and provided sources that were very difficult to verify. The content, for example, is only one aspect of her invention. In order to create an air of credibility, Shi Mao described herself as the daughter of a Chinese diplomat stationed in Russia who married a Russian man and listed her academic credentials on her user profile, including a doctoral degree in world history from Moscow State University. Recently, she also added that she was a pacifist and attached a petition that her husband had supposedly signed in protest of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Though Shi Mao occasionally feigned humility and expressed disgust with fakery, the investigation also found that she controlled at least 4 sock puppet accounts. These are alternative accounts that she used to create an illusion of support. Quote, "Please don't call me boss. I am just an ordinary student," Shi Mao wrote in reply to one of those fake accounts. Now, with another sock puppet account, she posed as a doctoral student in world history at Peking University who had studied in Russia and claimed to know Shi Mao in real life. Through one account, the inquisitive amateur was active since 2010. The investigation suggested that she only seized control of that account in 2019. Shi Mao's convincing persona as a modest scholar, won her trust in the community. So the question then is, Who on earth is this person? Who is Ji Mao in real life? She came clean in an apology letter issued on her Wikipedia account last month. She speaks neither English nor Russian and is a housewife with only a high school degree. Now, the hoax started with an innocuous intention. Unable to comprehend scholarly articles in their original language, she pieced sentences together with a translation tool and then filled in the blanks with her own imagination. Quote, as the saying goes, in order to defend a lie, you must tell more lies, she wrote. Now, before long, she had accumulated all of these words into tens of thousands of characters, which she obviously was reluctant to delete. The alternative accounts were imaginary friends that she cosplayed as when she was bored and alone, given that her husband was away most of the time, and she says she doesn't have any friends. She also apologized to actual experts on Russia, who she had attempted to cozy up to and later impersonated. Quote, the knowledge I have right now is not enough to make a living. In the future, I will learn a craft, work conscientiously, and not do pointless things like this anymore. And that's why you shouldn't use Wikipedia as a source for important information for research. I mean, wow. Just wow. Think about writing almost 300 articles, just piecing them together. She's a smart person. She has no training whatsoever on Russian history, but she's clearly a smart person, you know, and I hate to say it because I know there are a ton of people that write and curate Wikipedia in obvious good faith, but this isn't the first time that Wikipedia's had to deal with this type of thing. And I have to say, the past examples that I have are not as sophisticated, but this really is what undermines Wikipedia. So check out some of these other ones. When I went looking for this, went researching for this to kind of reinforce this, back in 2006, for example, the mustachioed man on the Pringles can, you know, was known as simply Mr. Pringle or the Pringles man. He didn't have a real name. And so a former Wikipedia editor known as Platypus Man decided to christen the mascot with a fairly simple prank. Platypus Man asked his former roommate to help invent a fake name, basically for the Pringles mascot. They landed on Julius Pringles, which was a derivation apparently of Julius Peppers, who was playing football on TV at the time when they were trying to figure this out. The duo then added that single line of trivia to the Pringles Wikipedia page. Quote, the man depicted in the Pringles logo is actually named Julius Pringles. Several years later, that lie became a reality. The name Julius Pringles was confirmed by the Pringles mascot in an animated Facebook video. According to Platypus Man, the lie only reached this point because of the status as a Wikipedia mod, and obviously with a little luck. So there you go. The Pringles man, the one on the can, did not have a name until some dude just made it up.
And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.